Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by contributors from community radio stations from coast to coast to coast. This episode of Groundwire was produced on the traditional territories of the Mississaugas of the New Credit by the Groundwire National Coordination Team in Toronto. I'm your host, Ome Salmarehemthula. Here are our headlines. Our first headline comes from radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, on occupied Anishinaabe Akin, homeland of the Métis Nation, and the historical territory of the Nahiyawak and the Nakota. Michael Welsh brings us an update on the Indigenous-led Spirit of the Buffalo Camp set up to oppose the replacement of Enbridge's Line 3 pipeline.
On Friday, October 19th, the sacred fire that had been lit for 100 days was finally put out, marking the official end of the prayer camp intended to raise awareness of and block Enbridge's Line 3 project through Manitoba. Spirit of the Buffalo Camp, as it was called, was stationed on a levee near the southwestern Manitoba community of Gretna, right where the pipeline crosses the Canada-US border. Geraldine McManus, the Dakota woman who established the camp, weathered multiple challenges over the past 3 months, from extreme heat to frigid temperatures to intense winds rolling in over the open prairie. On Saturday, October 20th, she described her reluctant decision to bring the camp to an end.
I really feel like as soon as I leave, Enbridge is going to come here onto this spot. I really feel that. And I don't want to go. But I'm so tired. I'm so sore. And I don't know what else to do anymore. I just don't know what else to do. I'm only following what ancestors are showing me. And that's all they can do.
Geraldine is committed to staying on site for a few more days before moving on with her life and her fight against this and other pipeline projects. This has been CKW's Michael Welch reporting for Groundwire.
Our next headline comes from Chris Cook of radio station CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria on unceded Coast Salish territory. He brings us this update on the Namagan campsite, which Groundwire covered in our last episode on October 8th. On election day in central Saanich, a police cruiser guards the gates of the recently collapsed Woodwind Farm, the latest campsite for the Namagan Nations. For Namagan's homeless campers, yellow tape and flashing lights seem to signal things to come. They've been moved along from one municipality to the other in British Columbia's capital region, with no hope yet of finding shelter from authorities who refuse to address the issue of endemic homelessness. In a Facebook post on Saturday, Namagan spokesperson Chrissy Brett says, quote, "If homeless people don't belong anywhere in a community, why not on the 188 acres owned by British Columbia?" Premier John Horgan and Minister of Municipal Affairs and Housing Selena Robinson, come to our table and talk reconciliation, not just reconciliation. Thanks to Chris Cook for that update. Our next headline comes again from CKUW in Winnipeg, where peace organizers hosted two special meetings on Canadian foreign policy.
The city of Winnipeg was the site of not just one, but two major events providing informed criticism of Canadian foreign policy abroad. The first event, sponsored by Peace Alliance Winnipeg, featured Montreal-based author and activist Yves Engler launching his book, Left Right, Marching to the Beat of Imperial Canada. It was held in one of the lecture halls at the Université de Saint-Boniface on Wednesday, October 17th, the third stop in his 14-city cross-Canada book tour. Engler elaborated on his thesis that while the establishment left in Canada continues to resist corporate power domestically, it mysteriously promotes and enables imperialist policy abroad.
When it comes to a politician conceding on domestic issues, we have a culture of challenging those commentators, of challenging those politicians, right? Of criticizing them if we feel like they're too right-wing. But we don't have that culture on international affairs. And we particularly don't have that culture on the weakest places, i.e. Africa being, many African countries being among the weakest parts of the world.
The second event was a public forum on the situation in Venezuela, put on by the Winnipeg-based Venezuela Peace Committee. The forum featured Steve Elner, professor of economics at the University of Oriente in Puerto La Cruz, Venezuela, and Carlos Ron, Venezuela's vice minister for foreign affairs, responsible for... Organizer Alan Freeman commented on the significance of this event for Canadians. On the Friday, October 19th...
The Canadian government is not taking a mediating role, but is acting as almost like a kind of attack dog of Donald Trump, which they should not be doing. This is the beginning of a long process of building bridges, which is the way we originally posed it, between the Venezuelan people and the Canadian people.
Plans are afoot for Steve Elner and Carlos Ron to speak in other Canadian cities in coming days. This has been CKW's Michael Welch reporting for Groundwire with files from Paul Graham.
Our final headline comes from Catherine Fisher of CJLY 93.5 FM on Sinaik's traditional territory.
This past spring, a number of people in Vancouver's downtown East Side came together to discuss research and ethics in the neighborhood in a series of Research 101 workshops convened by nonprofit group Hives for Humanity and presented by the Simon Fraser University Van City Office of Community Engagement. The workshops came out of a wider community conversation about ethics and cultural production in the neighborhood. These conversations allowed participants to share stories about communities and individuals in the neighborhood who have felt disrespected by research and the ways that research can increase inequality, contribute to stigma, exploit people's pain, and exhaust community members. Over the last few months, workshop attendees collectively built a document guiding potential researchers about the expectations the Downtown Eastside community members have. Called the Manifesto for Ethical Research in the Downtown Eastside, this document is now available on Simon Fraser University's Sustainability, Inequality, and Social Change Lab website. At a time when the neighborhood continues to be hard hit by the overdose crisis, housing crisis, and generations of colonial violence, there are hundreds of research projects ongoing in the Downtown East Side. The manifesto makes it clear that people in the Downtown East Side are not opposed to research, but they do want to reserve the right to refuse to participate, and they want to communicate a clear expectation that they want to see research that is respectful, useful, and ethical in their community.
That's it for the headlines. We'll be right back after this.
Again, when this strange night sees us growing, shading an image foreign to you, this I in my mind has opened from its hiding. It may hurt right now, there's no choice but to move somehow through the lonely sound. That the faith was just a mask, that pulled me back in cold. blue, and I can no ever do that to you.
You just heard Consort by Mitch Koda. You're listening to Groundwire Community Radio News, available online at groundwirenews.ca. Now it's time for our feature stories. Our first feature comes from Michael Welsh at CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe Akin, homeland of the Métis Nation and the historical territory of the Nahiowoc and the Nakota. He reviews Winnipeg's efforts to address the city's affordable housing crunch, including a controversial vote at City Hall in the midst of a municipal election.
On Thursday, September 20th, the City of Winnipeg approved a plan which would grant $8 million in property tax rebates to two companies building four towers in the downtown. True North Sports and Entertainment Limited, which owns the Winnipeg Jets and the Winnipeg Arena Complex, and Northland Properties are utilizing a tax increment financing mechanism which was intended for revitalization of neighborhoods in decline. However, affordable housing advocates have expressed outrage over the decision to waive a requirement previously associated with this regulation.
I'm Shauna McKinnon. I'm a professor here at the University of Winnipeg in the Department of Urban and Inner City Studies, and I'm also a member of the Right to Housing Coalition here in Manitoba. The issue is that there were rules put in place when tax increment financing was established that would require housing to be developed, rental housing, to include a percentage of units that would be affordable units. So that's just basically median market rent. That's not low-income housing. It's just, you know, median market rent housing. What happened in this case was that that was essentially waived for True North Square. You know, the technicalities of it is that the policy that required it had actually expired some time ago and hadn't been renewed. But the spirit of the agreement around tax increment financing here in Winnipeg has really been to ensure that in any development downtown, we include some affordable units of housing so that we ensure that people of all incomes can afford to live downtown. So with the city, the policy around downtown development, again, having an affordable component to it is really critical because, you know, we look at other major cities and the reality is that regular, you know, medium income earners, never mind low income earners, can't afford to live in downtown spaces. And so we want to really avoid that here. So when tax increment financing was established here through the legislation in the previous government, the previous provincial government, that was part of it, that we ensure that a percentage of units. And so, you know, we've had some of that development downtown, and we would have hoped that the spirit of that, the intent of tax increment financing, finance legislation here would continue so that we do more of that kind of development. In this case, True North Square, the proponents, for some reason, you know, did not felt that they should get the tax increment, you know, the you know, be able to get the $8 million or the 16 when you factor in the province and not have to have that requirement.
Winnipeg resident Carlos Sosa spoke in delegation against the approval of the rebate for True North at the September 20th meeting.
It is absolutely essential that the city of Winnipeg take leadership on issues of affordable housing, especially social housing for the most vulnerable in our city. And that includes the construction of new units. It's extremely disgusting that the city is putting the needs of the most wealthy ahead of the most vulnerable. And that needs to stop.
One amendment introduced in the wake of city residents registering their disapproval required that 10% of the property taxes the two owners would pay would go to an affordable housing grant to pay for affordable housing elsewhere. Shauna McKinnon was not impressed.
That's, you know, approximately $200,000, which is just outrageous. You can't build one single affordable unit with $200,000. So, you know, nice that they tried to do something to appease people at the last minute. Maybe we can push to expand on that somehow. I don't know. But it's just real. It's just quite ridiculous.
The motion in city council passed by a vote of 14 votes to 2. It takes place barely a month before the civic election, where affordable housing has not so far registered as a major election issue. Al Weeb is host of the CKUW program Of No Fixed Address and has lived experience with homelessness. He helped prepare a recent street census on homelessness in the city of Winnipeg and describes the findings on the CKUW program People of Interest.
In 2015, we had 1,400 and some odd folks, I think 60 some odd folks counted as being homeless. We'll never get them all because there's hidden homeless. And in 2018, that number went up to 1,560 some odd. So we went up instead of down. And the absolute homeless number went from 446 to 563. So we're not doing our job, you know, and more and more people are ending up on our streets than less. And that tells you a lot about where we are at and the work we're doing. The federal government says they're investing $40 billion to ending homelessness and hope to have 50% of the homeless ended in 10 years. That's pie-in-the-sky thinking, I think. We have to see what happens in the next federal election, whether a lot of that $40 billion is still going to be there. But the government has to invest that kind of money. The provincial government has to be on board. This municipal, the city government has to be on board. And right now they're not. And they have to take the lead in all of this.
Election day in Winnipeg is October 24th. Affordable housing advocates believe remedies for the city's most vulnerable are available if the city's new government has the will to implement them.
Cities all too often say, you know, it's out of our hands. We don't have the tools. There's only so much we can do. It's the feds. It's the province. But we argue that yes, well, that is true to some extent. There are things that they can use, and so they should be using the tools that are available to them to make access to housing, to ensure access to housing for everybody.
People have to realize that the homeless people have names like ours, and they are people like us who just got a bad break. And, mm-hmm. you know, people coming down from the reserves, 75% of individuals on the street are Indigenous, and, you know, many of them come from the communities up north, and they just come for a better life. And, you know, you end up on Main Street, you can't get a job, and you end up with the wrong crowd a lot of times. And once you're out there, it's hard to escape. But, you know, people are like you and I are, and they're not something less than, they're not monsters either.
From Winnipeg, on occupied Anishinaabe Gakin, the homeland of the Métis Nation and the historical territory of the Nahiowak and the Nakota, this is CKUW's Michael Welch for Groundwire, with files from Susan Hubert and Terry Broza.
Our next feature comes from Matt Cicero from CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa on the traditional unceded territory of the Algonquin Anishinaabe people. On November 6, 2017, Dipan Budlakoti, a Canadian-born man made stateless in 2011, was arrested by the Ontario Provincial Police in connection with alleged weapons offences. In this piece, we'll hear from Budlakoti, who has been engaged in a high-profile battle with Citizenship and Immigration Canada since his citizenship was stripped from him. We will also be hearing from Daniel Kaylee Doust, spokesperson for Justice for Dipan, and Diane Ralph, a supporter. Kaylee Doust and Ralph have been helping Budlakoti regain his citizenship and get access to medical care while imprisoned in the Ottawa-Carlton Detention Centre.
Reporting for Groundwire, I'm Matt Cicero. It's not the first time that Dipan Budlakoti has spent time in the Ottawa-Carlton Detention Center. He was there in 2010. It's where his immigration problems first began. Maybe he's turned full circle then, because today his immigration status is the cause of his incarceration. While some things have changed in the last 7 years, Budlakoti was stripped of his citizenship in 2011, others have not. Racism, central to his loss of citizenship, is also a big part of why he's in the Ottawa-Carlton Detention Center awaiting trial. Dipan Budlakoti called me collect from the range where he's imprisoned. The recording's not the best. He's on an old phone, in an old prison. In the background, you can hear the sounds of the 23 other prisoners he's incarcerated with.
When the whole thing started, it was racial profiling. I was held at Ottawa-Carlton Detention Center, and a white guard, came up to me and asked me if I was a citizen or not. Based on that, he contacted CPSA, which is documented on access information request. Now, because of that process, I have gone down the road of being completely stateless. All my co-accused got bail.
Why do you think they received bail while you didn't?
My case is high profile in terms of immigration matters and the fact that I'm brown, I have a beard. The system itself is just systemic racism inbred into the system. As is, so it's harder for people of color to get bail than individuals that are Caucasian.
The Ottawa Carleton Detention Center, or OCDC, is known as one of the worst prisons in Ontario. Three prisoners committed suicide there in 2015 and 2016. This resulted in an inspection by then-Minister of Community Safety and Correctional Services, Yasser Naqvi, as well as a task force mandated with improving conditions at the detention center. Most of the prisoners in the OCDC are held short-term, but some, like Budlakati, end up housed there for months or even years.
We're living in a hallway where they have tables, a TV, 24 other inmates. You walk back and forth in the hallway with four phones. You eat in your cell with no window to see out of, no table, so you sit on the floor. It's like someone outside lives in their washroom. They eat in the washroom, they live in the washroom. This is how we get treated here. They come on a range. The range windows, you have nothing, you can't see nothing outside the range windows or nothing coming in because it's caked on with desk and cells and dirt. You're locked up 21 hours plus a day in a cell. Yet you're supposed to be innocent until proven guilty.
Prisoners stuck in the OCDC suffer physically and mentally. Budlakoti, who has serious physical and mental health problems, has been forced to fight day in and day out for months in order to get access to medical care. Diana Ralph is one of Budlakoti's supporters, as well as a social worker and psychotherapist. She was helping him before he was imprisoned and has continued to advocate for him afterwards. She has been particularly active trying to ensure that he gets the medical attention he needs.
I just would like to talk about how profoundly I respect Deepan. In these horrible conditions, he keeps his cool. He is constantly appreciative and respectful. He just keeps fighting. You know, he's not letting the system break him. No exercise, lousy food, dangerously crowded conditions with temperature extremes that are unbearable. That's enough to cause serious illness. But for mental health, it's much worse even. People are constantly being humiliated and told that they're worthless and bad and that they are powerless and that the arbitrary authorities can treat them any way they want. And they're isolated. It's almost as if you took a recipe for how to install trauma in people and they do it on purpose.
Budlakoti will be in court at the Ottawa Provincial Courthouse on October 30th and 31st. Anyone who wants to support him is invited to attend. Regardless of the final outcome of his charges, he will remain stateless for the foreseeable future because the Liberal government has so far refused to restore his citizenship. Statelessness, says Daniel Kaylee Daou, a spokesperson for the Justice for Deepan Committee, is at the heart of Budlakoti's suffering.
Actually, stateless had everything to do with the options he had when he was out of jail and why he was declared stateless in the first place through decisions, politically motivated decisions by both CBSA and the previous conservative government to declare him stateless and attempt to deport him to a country where he'd never been.
This has been a Groundwire production from Ottawa, Algonquin Territory.
Put on this face at the start of the day to spirit revealed, yet you've nothing to say. Oh, what a vision I see now in you. But do you see me as each side of the two? to be given this body. Yet I feel like a mother inside, growing tired of the wanting breath. If it ends, where do I find the words of a bloodless locality? Half evaded, these eyes shifting right. Take the door to find these arms reaching out, but none of them hold me as tight. What now? What now?
Greg McDougall, you just heard the rest of Consort by Mitch Coda. That's it for this edition of Groundwire, produced by the Groundwire National Coordination Team. Headlines this week were written by Michael Welsh, Catherine Fisher, and Chris Cook. Features were provided by Matt Cicero and Michael Welsh. We also thank Gal Mahadevan for her contributions. Music this week was from Mitch Coda. I've been your host, Ome Salma Rahimtula. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station or download at groundwirenews.ca. Thanks for tuning in.